You are listening to Podski Wee Wee, a proud member of the Canadian Football Podcast Network.
Now back to pass, and Nichols is going to go down. Dominic Ellis comes from his linebacker spot for the sack, his first of the season. Yarder must seem like, oh, it's blocked! Hamilton on top of it. Maybe that's the fire started by a spark. That blitz again. Picked up nicely by the Cats. And nice play. Somehow, DeMar Altman was able to slip out of the grass and take it to the end zone, and suddenly, the Hamilton Tiger Cats are in this thing.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham.
Another week, Mike. Another loss for our Tie Cats. I don't even know what to say, honestly. This team, it seems like they take one step forward, even in a losing effort, and then a week later, it's like not even two steps backwards. It's like 90 steps backwards. And it's really starting to get to me because it feels like it's the same stuff week in and week out as to why this team is losing. I honestly feel like we could just take a previous game recap that we did like 2 weeks ago and like dub in different names. Like, do you remember that Simpsons episode where they were talking about the Super Bowl and it's like the Atlanta Falcons? That's what I feel like we could do. Like, we could sit here and go, we could take last 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, whatever, and say like the Hamilton Tiger Cats played the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, and we're talking about the same stuff. It's poor offensive line play. It's a lack of a desire to run the football. It's an inability to get stops on second down, and it's allowing 30-plus points a game. Like, how often can we just talk about these things and not bore ourselves talking about them and bore the audience listening to them? These post-game recaps are getting redundant because every single week it's the same stuff. So we can talk about what the offense did, what the defense did, and what special teams did, but does it really even matter if we're just saying the same thing over and over again?
No, basically not. I mean, if I were listening to this show, I would get kind of tired of it too. I mean, you're right. Secondary, offensive line, all that stuff is just over and over. These things are not getting fixed, and I don't see them getting fixed anytime soon. I've kind of lost hope on this season after that loss against Winnipeg, and you could say, you know, 0-6, you should lose hope at that point. But I really thought that for some reason I was watching that game and I thought at some point in the third or fourth quarter they were going to turn it around and make a run for this win. But it just never came, and it's really, really frustrating to watch this team just be so, so terrible week in and week out. And we can talk about small improvements like we have before in previous games, but it just doesn't seem to sustain week to week. So it's tough to watch.
I kind of had the same feeling as you did when they were getting those stops on Winnipeg's offense in the first half and forcing them to kick field goals. And then they get the blocked field goal. I think that was in the third quarter, which leads directly into the touchdown drive. Like, I'm thinking, okay, they're down by 10. Like, I wasn't totally out of it. And then it just becomes turnover city. The Bombers get a ton of pressure on Zach Caleros, fumbles, interceptions, then the Bombers score. Like, they were holding the Bombers, not scoreless because the Bombers were scoring, but they were holding them to mostly field goals throughout the entire first half. And you think, okay, those might come back to haunt Winnipeg. And then it's just there's that extra gear that Winnipeg has that Hamilton doesn't. And next thing you know, it's a 27-point loss. Like, it was a 10-point game late in the third quarter, and then all of a sudden it got out of hand.
Yeah, the fourth quarter, Winnipeg scored 17 points and the Tiger Cats scored nothing. So it came down to crunch time. Tiger Cats had a chance to make a push, make this game close, maybe even win it, and they put up 0 points on the board.
Yeah, you're down by 10 at home, and you've just scored to cut that lead. And yeah, they didn't get the two-point convert, but the touchdown by Altman was awesome. Like, that was just it. You can say it was poor tackling on Winnipeg's part or whatever, but he made a bunch of moves, he made guys miss, and he found the end zone. Like, we're talking about incremental successes and small victories. The play of this kid has been one of them. The two games he's been in, I think he's looked phenomenal, and it continues this sort of not resurgence, but this the Ticats can find receivers. We used to praise Jim Barker all those years for finding these guys for the Argos, these diamonds in the rough that no one else took. The Ticats are finding those guys. Jalen Saunders has had big games and has been a contributor on this team. Altman comes in and he's scored touchdowns in his first two games. Like, they're finding these young guys, but nothing else seems like we get this one little glimmer of hope, and then everything else is garbage.
Yep, I couldn't say it any better. The offensive line again was terrible.
I heard
something like, I think they had 5 sacks and 10 pressures, and week after week we talk about this. I don't know what else to say. I don't know how to fix it, really. I mean, we bring in Tony Washington, and I'm not sure how he played exactly. But then, you know, Fulton's not playing. And if we have those guys all together on the line, I think they could be a decent group. But I'm not sure how long Fulton's out for. And it's Washington was there maybe a week and he was thrown into the fire. So I don't know. I remember we were talking about, someone told me that the Ticats don't like to do max protect. Have you noticed this since we talked about it, that they just don't – they always have just 5 offensive linemen and then Gable in the backfield trying to block?
Maybe a running back, maybe a fullback. Absolutely. And the thing is, too, and the problem with this as well is I will watch them. You'll see CO Prime come in, and it's like, well, this is very clearly a running play because they're going to have him in there to block, and then they pick up like 2 yards on the ground, and then they give up on the run like they always do. And you don't see a ton of max protect. And if the quarterback is getting his lunch handed to him, which Zach Collaros was running for his life in this game, like, I'm not saying they should make a quarterback change for performance reasons. Like, Collaros hasn't been good, but he hasn't been given an ability to be good. Like, he's not getting the time out there to find his receivers and make his third and fourth read to throw balls. But maybe just to save him and save him from getting hurt, they could make a quarterback change, because he's getting killed out there. You mentioned the pressures. Yeah, you had the numbers right. 10 pressures in this game, 5 sacks. They've allowed 67 pressures on the season, which is dead last in the league. They've allowed 20 sacks on the season, which is third from last. They're 2 above the last 2 place teams, which I think are BC and Montreal. So they're just getting killed out there. And they don't run the football. We know that very well. And they can't get any sort of blocking to get Zach. Like, he's going to get killed out there. If he lasts a season, I'll be shocked.
And you can see it in the way he's playing, that he's worried about getting hit. And I don't blame him. It's just been terrible protection for a while now. And I remember one play specifically, Zach, he didn't have pressure on him, but he thought he saw someone coming, and he kind of jumped back into the pressure, and it turned into a sack. And he could have stayed in the pocket and thrown the ball, but he got a little timid, and he is worried about getting hurt. I'm positive of it. And I don't blame him.
You know, we keep talking about the tackles that they rotate in, and we don't really give any sort of guff to the interior Canadians there. Have we overrated Bombin, Filer, and Revenberg? Because they did look pretty good last year. Bombin's been an all-star in this league. I think Filer's one of the most underrated players in the league, but maybe we're thinking that these guys are good and they're not.
Yeah, I thought about that the other night too. It can't be like all on the tackles. There is pressure coming through the middle. I still think highly of those guys, but yeah, you have to start asking the questions. Are these guys, you know, top line Canadian offensive linemen? And I'm not sure they are anymore. I could be totally wrong on that. I'm not watching those guys play every single play, but you know, pressure's coming from every which way, so it has to be somewhat their fault too.
So that's pretty much it that I got for the offense. Collaros was running for his life. Altman had that nice catch and looked pretty decent in the game, and the O-line can't block anyone. So why don't we just jump over to the defense? And sure, it looks like that change in coordinators didn't make much of a difference now, did it?
No, it did not. Did you notice that they were dropping 10 yards back, the DBs, on a lot of plays?
Sure did.
What is up with that? That's not working.
Not at all. There was one play in particular that I have to single out. I believe it was a 2nd and 5, maybe even a 2nd and 8. And Matt Nichols found Darvin Adams for like a 12-yard pickup. And the back that was covering him, I don't want to say who it was because I do not remember who it was. So I'm not going to mention anyone by name because I don't want to call it the wrong guy. But he was 5 yards off him when Adams caught the ball on the out route that he was running for a first down. Like, you're giving these guys first down yardage. It's just, again, like I said, we can dub in stuff from weeks ago. They do not get stops on second down. They gave up. They got the Winnipeg Blue Bombers converted 58% of their first downs in this second downs in this game. That's even worse than the Ticats' season average, which is already a league worst 55%. That's horrible. You give teams a chance to convert on second down like that, you're going to lose a football game. And when they didn't allow the Bombers to get a first down on the second down, I think they stopped them 11 times on second down. Eight of those went for field goal attempts. So they let them drive down the field into scoring territory anyway. That is brutal.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Rich Stubler defense with the Argonauts years ago. You know, the bend but don't break. These guys are bending and breaking. It's like, yeah, it's brutal to watch, man. A philosophy has to change, and you think it would have with Philip Lawley coming in as new defensive coordinator, but it just seems to be the same stuff. So, I don't know. They're going to have to change something drastic. Like, just challenge these guys. Challenge the receivers. Make them work for these first downs. Don't just let them play catch in the backyard. That's what it seems like right now.
I get playing off the guy on the wide side of the field because the chances of he's obviously the last read on a play, and the chances of Nichols finding that, if that happens, that happens. But it's when they're the slot receivers and they're back, like, it's mind boggling how often this happens. And we're not experts by any stretch of the imagination. Maybe there's a reason they're doing this, but I can't figure it out. And maybe smarter minds than me can tip us off in the comment section or on Twitter and after they listen to the show and tell us why they think the Ticats are doing this, because to me it makes absolutely no sense.
None whatsoever. Yeah. All I know is the defense is letting offenses run all over them and pass all over them and rack up huge amount of yards and points. So to me, they should change something in the philosophy of the defense because it's not working, guys. It's just not working.
And the thing in this game, too, they didn't allow a 300-yard passer, which shocked me. I thought Matt Nichols was well above 300 yards. I thought he was throwing the ball around the park all day. When I came home and saw the stats and saw he had like 267, I was shocked. They didn't allow a 100-yard receiver. But these are not things that we should be celebrating. These are things that should be happening every single week. And they gave up 30-plus points again. Like, nothing seems to be working on either side of the ball. And you bring up the bend but don't break. Stubler was allowed to get away with that because his offense was so good that they were putting up points. So if you're giving up field goals but you're scoring touchdowns, you can play bend but don't break. Problem is the Ticats are not scoring points. They scored 12 points in this game. You know how hard it is to score just 12 points in the CFL game? I think if we looked at – I don't think any other team has scored that few in a game maybe all season outside of the Ticats. Like, you don't get low-scoring games like that. Like, it's very, very rare where you'll see teams score – barely over 10 points. Like, you're getting 14 to 17 points. We were making fun of the Alouettes start of the season because they hadn't cracked 20. Ticats have had games where they scored 15, 12, and 1. Like, that's awful. Just awful.
Yeah, especially the way the offenses are putting up points this year. I would bet that points per game are probably up. So everybody else is scoring points, it seems, except for the Ticats. And Andrew Harris had a hell of a game, 14 carries, 107 yards. So this defense used to stop the run on a consistent basis. You couldn't run against this defense in past years, and now I'm seeing running backs run for 100 yards plus on the regular, it seems.
The linebackers on this team have just not been playing well. When's the last time Simone Lawrence made a big play? When's the last time you heard Larry Dean's name? And I like both those players. I like them. They've been favorites of mine the entire time they've been here, but at what point do you look at them and go, when are the stars of this team going to start making plays? It's the same with special teams. At what point do we start going, Brandon Banks just doesn't have it anymore? He's not making plays. Zach Caleros is not making plays. We don't hear, yes, there's injuries and players are out and all that other sorts of stuff, but there's still star players in this team. Guys who are making big bucks, who we consider to be all-star caliber players, and they're not making plays. John, when's the last time you heard John Chick's name?
Good question.
It's been a while.
I think he had a forced fumble maybe last game or the game before, but he hasn't been the same John Chick that we've seen over his career. The first seven games of the season, I don't think.
No, like none of these guys on defense are making plays. We used to have a ball hawking secondary, and yes, Emmanuel Davis has been hurt, and we've lost guys like Eric Harris to the NFL, but still, they've replaced those guys. One of the guys we'll talk about a little bit later that was making plays, they released in Will Hill. We're not going to get into – we'll get into why he was cut later. But it's like they don't have any playmakers on this defense. And that used to be what they were known for. Remember a couple years ago when they were on pace to break the record for most defensive touchdowns in the season? When's the last time this team scored on defense? Like I think they have, what, one – that one interception return against Saskatchewan this year? And otherwise, it's been it's just been awful.
Yeah, it has been awful. The secondary has been terrible. And, you know, kind of jumping all over the place here, I kind of forgot. But jumping to the offensive side of the ball for a second, Mike Jones had a terrible game. Did you not think?
Yeah, he did. That was a rough outing for him.
I mean, it's funny because he wanted some of those drops to be incomplete passes. And when do you ever see a receiver, like, asking the refs to make it an incomplete pass because they're fumbles or whatnot? It was just... I like Mike Jones, but he had a really bad game.
Yeah, he absolutely did. I in my piece for Three Down this week on the game, I did mention that because he has been really good. If you look at the numbers and look at what he's on pace for and stuff like that, he's on pace to put up numbers that you don't normally see from the guy that plays that position, that fifth Canadian, that wide side receiver spot. But yeah, this was rough. What did he have? A fumble. He had the drop that was almost a return for a touchdown that they called a fumble that came back. He caught the 2-point convert and let it get knocked out of his hands. Yeah, it was a tough night for number 12.
Yes, I don't like seeing that. You know, you hope it doesn't shake his confidence, a young kid like that.
Yeah, I think he got pulled from the game too after the second fumble. Well, first fumble, the other one was ruled incomplete, but I'm pretty sure he was pulled out. And then Giovanni Aprile came in and caught his first pass of his career, which is saying something for a guy who's been in the CFL for over 5 years.
That was his first catch?
That was his first catch of his career.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I thought he at least had a couple, but wow.
No, he was taken in, I want to say, like the third round by the Bombers. So Joe Mack rears his ugly head again. Worst case scenario, at least we don't have Joe Mack as GM.
This is true. I mean, that was a mess in Winnipeg. He really hurt that franchise for a couple of years, but they seem to be back on track now.
Yeah, keeping this on track. Let's move. If you're done with defense, we can move to special teams, but there's not much to talk about here. They didn't attempt a field goal. They didn't attempt an extra point. They did nothing of note in the return game or in the coverage game. The only thing I can say about special teams, they had the block. Yes, they did have the block, but I want to single out Connor McGough. I want to single him out because he showed on a few punt returns, he showed some great hustle and made some plays, got some tackles. But yeah, the block kick is pretty much like that's it. Like and it led to the touchdown. But those things just used to be momentum turning plays for this team. They would get a block, and this used to be things we would see every week. There'd be some sort of special teams gadget play that they would do. And now we're lucky to see them. I don't understand why they don't go to those things. Like I'm in the stands watching, going, why aren't they trying to do an onside punt here? Or like just do something to try to get yourself back into this game. There's no creativity on special teams anymore.
No, when Ryan Bold was running the show, there was a lot of – I haven't seen that onside punt that we used to do all the time for a while now. They tried the fake punt pass two or three games ago, and that turned out horribly. But that was more on the punter not getting the laces, and he just took too much time. But yeah, it's 2015, man. Yeah, the offense was amazing. Defense was awesome. Special teams was making plays. All three stages, or all three sides of the ball, if you want to say that, were clicking, and now there's none of it. Just none of it.
No, it's no unit on this team is doing much of anything, and that's why we're sitting here talking about an 0-7 football team.
Yeah, and you know Courtney Stephen was back, and or he wasn't injured, but Emmanuel Davis was back, and we have Courtney Stephen. I thought Dominic Ellis had a decent game, and I thought the defense did well. You know, not allowing touchdowns, but it's just, I mean, when they kick, what was it, like 54 field goals? I mean, that adds up, right?
Yeah, they had 8 field goal tries, and Medlock nailed 6 of them. One he doinked off the upright, another one was the block, and. Yeah, if you're giving up 6 field goals, you have a chance to win the game. But when you're giving up 6 field goals and like 3 touchdowns, then you're in a little bit of trouble.
I think we should move on from this.
Yeah, okay. I don't disagree with you on that one. So let's talk about some Ticats news. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. They made a ton of moves over the past week since you and I last sat down. They released a total of 5 players. They signed 6 others. We talked about the Tony Washington addition last week. But in conjunction with that, when it was officially released, they also added the following players: defensive lineman Mike McAdoo, defensive back Kariel Brooks, wide receiver Jarrell Robinson, defensive lineman Nikita Whitlock, and just today, defensive end Ryan Mueller. McAdoo was with the team in camp, or in spring. He was released in May, spent some time with the Dallas Cowboys, and he actually has some CFL experience, played a couple of games with the Bombers in 2013. Brooks was in camp with the Argos, and then he was released. Robinson has not played in the CFL, but he spent a few years down south, and he played in 3 games for the Cleveland Browns in 2014. Whitlock might be the most notable of these guys. He started 14 games for the New York Giants in 2015 as a fullback, and then Mueller's with the Cats in training camp and the preseason, and was released on those final roster cuts in June. So not really any household names here, but I guess they're still trying to uncover guys to bring in, and at least it looks like they're trying to make changes to get this team settled, or to find guys that can play. But I don't think any of these guys played this past week, and I'm not sure if they'll get any playing time anytime soon. But I know it's a small thing, and you might even jump at me for saying it, but at least they're doing something to try to improve the talent on this team. That's the best I can do with these signings.
Yeah, they've been doing that all season and all last year. It's a revolving door of players in and out and in and out. It's just, I appreciate the fact that they're trying to get better, but I don't know if it hurts them or makes them better, because there's so much change week to week. So I don't really have much to say on those player signings, because to be honest, I don't really know any of those players. So I couldn't give you an honest opinion.
We can talk, however, about the guys that they let go. They released 5 players this past week. Quarterback Logan Kilgore, who served as their number 3 quarterback in 6 games this year, and his release coincided with Everett Golson being back from injury and being on the roster as the 3rd quarterback in the game against Winnipeg. Quintarius Eatman started 2 games for the team the last couple of weeks, but I guess the addition of Tony Washington made him expendable. Ethan Davis, who was acquired from Montreal in February in exchange for Brian Simmons, played in 2 games this year, had 13 tackles, but he if I recall, there was a game a couple weeks ago. Not sure if it was the Calgary game. It might have been the I can't remember what game it was, but he looked really bad. It might have been the game against BC, but he looked really bad, so his release is not all that surprising. But the 2 big names, the ones that we're probably going to talk the most about, Kevin Elliott and Will Hill, were both let go. Were you surprised by any of these? Well, those two in particular, were you surprised by those releases?
Mm-hmm. Not so much the Elliott, but the Will Hill kind of caught me by surprise. But maybe it shouldn't have, but I thought that he played pretty well when he's been in there this season. Yes, he had some issues, and, you know, coming into the team, there were, you know, talk about who he was as a person. Maybe he was a distraction in the locker room, all that stuff. But I thought, just going by the play on the field, I was surprised by his release. Kevin Elliott, I think he's a talented guy, but it might be the same kind of thing. He's a bit of a issue off the field or in the locker room. And, you know, I wasn't a fan of the ball spinning, especially when it was a 5-yard gain, and he just seemed to do it every time. It just kind of bothered me. I'm sure that had nothing to do with his release, but it was just kind of a small trait that bothered me about him. So a little bit of a shock for both of them, but more so with Will Hill.
Hill's release stunned me until I then read about some words from Ken Austin and maybe why he was let go. It seemed like he was late for meetings. He had left practice early. So it seems like he was a bit of a hothead. And I would have said he was Hamilton's best defensive player. But when your team's losing and they weren't winning with him, so losing him didn't really do all that much. And Dominique Ellis had taken his position as the Sam linebacker. And if you're a knucklehead and you're not contributing to victories, That type of attitude will get you cut. If the team was winning, maybe he's still around. Maybe his attitude's not the same. And I kind of get the same feeling with Elliott. Elliott, to me, I was excited when they re-signed him in the offseason. I was excited when they picked him up last year. I thought, and he played well. Like, he played 5 games with the team, caught 19 passes for 247 yards and a touchdown. But this year he played in just 2 games, and he was beaten out, plain and simple. We've seen DeMar Altman and we've seen Jalen Saunders play, and those guys have played better than Elliott has. So he was let go, and he seems to me to be, and we look back on the time he was with the Argos, if things aren't going well, it seems like he's allowed to walk out the door. So when things were going bad in Toronto, there was all that talk that the reason all those guys were released is because they weren't buying in, and they were bad in the locker room. Maybe it's the same reason here. And now he's on the street looking for work, and so is Hill. And if you have an attitude problem, and I'm not saying they do, that's just the conjecture out there. But if you have a bad attitude and your team's not winning, it's very easy to show them the door.
Absolutely. And just touching on the Kevin Elliott thing, we don't really have a lot of height in this receiving corps right now, do we? I mean, I'm not sure how Jalen Saunders seems like a shorter guy, and Altman I don't think is that tall. I could be wrong on this, completely wrong, but it just seems like we're lacking size with receivers right now.
You know what? I'm going to look this up so we don't look like fools saying there's no one on this receiving corps who's bigger than like 6'2". Because, no, you're right. It does feel like there's not a ton of height in this receiving corps. And, yeah, the tallest guy is Brian Timms at 6'3". And then you have a lot of guys who are 6 feet and under. Mike Jones is 6 feet. Saunders is 5'9". Tasker's 5'11". Altman's 5'11". Like, that's Banks, if you want to count him as a receiver, 5'7". Like, that's not a ton of height in the receiving corps. Now, Fantuz comes back later in the year. There's a guy that's like 6'4". So there, but yeah, you're right. This is a very tiny receiving unit.
And I suppose they weren't expecting Tolliver to be injured for the season. First game, so yeah, they would have had some height there if he would have not been injured. So yeah, it seems like we have a bunch of smaller guys out there, and I guess we do.
So we got to talk about Johnny Manziel, because it seems like because the Ticats are terrible, that the Johnny Manziel stuff is out and about again. This time it's an article on TSN by Dave Naylor, who, again, I feel like we have to preface this with everything. I like Dave Naylor, but he writes this article about how the Ticats should sign Johnny Manziel, and it's the perfect time, and they need this. And there was one passage in particular that really struck out to me, and I'll read it verbatim. He said, "Barring a dramatic turnaround this season, Hamilton is going to need a way to get fans excited about 2018, perhaps sooner than later. Nothing would do that like the potential of a Manziel resurrection in black and gold." Now, I may be in the minority here, but the idea of Johnny Manziel playing for the Ticats doesn't really excite me all that much. It's not going to make me more eager to renew my season tickets. It's not going to make me going, "Oh, I can't wait till next season." Like, Johnny Manziel's an exciting player. I loved watching him in college. He's done absolutely nothing in the pros. He was awful with the Cleveland Browns. Maybe he can come up here and play well, but I just, this doesn't do anything for me. And maybe there'll be some Ticat fans out there who'll be like, no, absolutely, I want Johnny football here and I want to watch him play. But to me, this is like, I read that passage and I go, not for me. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I don't think the Hamilton Tiger Cats need that boost from the fan base. I think they have a really strong fan base and a good season ticket base, and they sell out all the time. And now that might change soon with all this losing. But I don't think you need to bring in a big U.S. college star like Johnny Manziel to sell tickets in Hamilton. Now in Toronto, I guarantee you that place would be sold out if Johnny Manziel was a starting quarterback for the Toronto Argonauts. That's a place where he could go. And if you're going to sign a player to sell tickets, that's the place he should go. But obviously the Ticats have his rights. So yeah, I don't agree with Naylor. I think that you bring in Manziel and he's not better than Claros. You bring in Manziel and he's going to get killed just like Claros is getting killed out there by the offensive line, even though Manziel is extremely mobile. We know that, but, yeah, I don't see the merit in that, bringing him in. I just don't see the point of it.
Johnny Manziel is not a better CFL quarterback than anyone on the Ticats roster right now. He's not a better quarterback than Zach Caleros. He's not a better CFL quarterback than Jeremiah Mazzoli. And he's not a better CFL quarterback than Everett Golson. Could be one day if he ever decides to come up here. But one of the big reasons I'm also kind of sour on this idea is that he's stated very publicly that his goal is to get back to the NFL. So him coming to the CFL would be short term at best. He does not want to play in the Canadian Football League. He wants to play in the National Football League. So I got no problems with players coming up here. We've seen it time and time again. Players come up here because, for whatever reason, to resurrect their careers, to get a chance down south. But guys like Eric Harris and Delvin Bro, recent Justin Hickman, guys that played for the Ticats that I can name, didn't come up here and hadn't publicly stated, "Yeah, my goal is to play in the NFL." We obviously knew that's every football player's goal because of the money you can make down there. But if his goal is to just go back to the NFL, then he's up here, what, maybe 2 years? And if he's only up here 2 years, will he really immerse himself into the CFL culture? Like, this is not the same as the NFL. And yes, the NFL is more business, and you got to you're constantly working and all that sorts of stuff. The CFL is a much more community-based thing. And will he immerse himself in the Hamilton community and go out and do those things and be that? If he's the starting quarterback for the team, which is what Naylor's article presupposes that he could be in 2018 if he came up now, then he's got to be the face of the franchise. And is he going to do all those media appearances? Is he going to do all those charity appearances? Is he going to go to those hospitals? Like, is he willing to do all that stuff? Because his persona that he's given off is that he's a party boy and all that other sorts of stuff doesn't really lend itself to giving the guy the keys to the franchise.
And I don't think he's going to come in and earn $500,000 like top quarterbacks do in this league. I think that he'll come in on a modest salary, and I don't think Money Manziel will be able to swallow his pride and take $150,000 or $200,000 or whatever it might be. So I just don't see it happening unless it's with another team.
Yeah. So anyway, it was out there. I figured we could talk about it. I think we both said our piece on it. I hope we are, unless Johnny Manziel signs a contract with the CFL team, I hope this is the last that you and I sit down and say his name on this show. Let's move on to the CFL news. There's not a ton of news, but there are a couple of things that I want to talk to you about because they're of interest to me. The NFL recently, as in like about less than a week ago, they came out and said they're going to hire some of their referees full time. It took about 15 seconds before someone said the CFL should do the same. And there's a piece going up on 3 Down Nation later this week that I wrote about this. So if you want my opinions on it, you'll see them there. I'll give some here. But I'd like to get your take on this. What do you think about the idea of the CFL hiring some referees on full time?
What does that mean, though? Like full time? Like what does that entail? I mean, there's only so many months that the season is on. What do they do in the off season? Like, I don't understand what full time means to be a football referee.
In reading the stuff about the NFL referees, it's they are paid year round, and then during the off season, they are doing seminars to get better. It was very vague because obviously it's new, but they're going to train essentially like players do. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's physical training, although I'm sure that's part of it, but it's getting into the rule book and knowing the stuff and being able to make calls better. And this is it's interesting you bring this up because to me, I don't think hiring these guys on full time really would make that much of a difference. I don't think preparation is the problem because there are times, and people like to rip Andre Rule for this because he's the scapegoat for all things bad in CFL refereeing. I don't believe that. I think he's the best ref in the league. However, there are times when he's pulling out obscure rules that you're just like, how does he know that? So to me, it's not a prep thing with these referees. The referees know what is and isn't the call. The problem is they're human, and you can only make quick judgment calls as well as you can. It's not – until they are replaced by robots, there's not going to be a way to be able to say, was that a catch or a fumble? That's what replay's there for, and even replay's not great. And I think people lump in replay with the referees and say the CFL has an officiating problem. I don't think the CFL has an officiating problem any more than any other league does. I think the referees across the board in the CFL are as good as the referees in any other major pro sports league. You're going to find people, fans of every sports league, complaining about the officials regardless. And then you're going to find people complaining about the NFL referees when they're full-time. In fact, that's going to be used against them. He's a full-time ref. How did he miss that call? You're going to see that. The problem to me is the command center. The command center is the one that I think is the issue, and that when people say there's a referee problem, they mean there's a command center problem. And I think both are getting lumped together, and I don't think that's fair to our refs.
Yeah, they don't differentiate between like the refs and the command center because the refs make the announcement, right? So
yeah,
I mean, I
understand the messenger thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I agree with you about the proof thing. I think he gets a lot of flack for many different reasons that aren't really fair to him. So yeah, I don't know if full-time refs gonna make it better. They'd have to raise the salaries, obviously, because if these guys are gonna be a full-time job refing, then they're gonna have to quit their other jobs that they have. So I don't know, I just don't see them making this jump yet, because obviously the NFL has so much more money than the CFL, and they can easily afford to pay the refs full-time.
Well, and the number is 21 to 24 refs over the next few years that they're going to make full-time. That's about 20% of their workforce, so that'd be about 8 referees in the CFL. There are 8 head refs, and the NFL is going to make not just head referees full-time. They're going to divvy it out to all seven officiating positions. But you bring up an interesting point, the salary. CFL, the CFL minimum right now is $53,000. Is that a fair wage for a referee? Should a referee be making as much as a player? If not, should they be making less? If they're making less, now we're dipping into the $30,000 to $40,000 territory. Is that enough? Like, this is the thing. Yeah, it's great the NFL, like you said, they have billions of dollars. Billions of dollars that they can sink into. Their players are making millions. I don't want to see a league where the referees are making more than players on the field, because to me, if you're going to, you have to take the money from somewhere, and I'd rather have the money going to the players, because you can pay more, you can attract better players. Yes, you're never going to get into a bidding war with an NFL team for a player like you did 40 years ago, but the players need to make more money before we start talking about giving the refs more money. And like I said, I don't think the officiating is that big of an issue, and it's no more of an issue in the CFL than it is in any other sports league. So I don't see the need to make these guys full time.
No, neither do I. And you know, when all this challenge stuff, all the challenges came up, and I was all for it. I wanted everything to be called perfectly. And after a couple of years of that, and now we're back to, you know, less challenges, and it's I can accept a couple blown calls. You know, it's just for the sake of the game, it's just so much better without all these challenges. I can accept that the refs are going to make mistakes once in a while.
Speaking of making mistakes, I want to talk about Jonathan Jennings. And I want to start this by saying you and I both love Jonathan Jennings. I do. I'm pretty sure in all our conversations, I think you've said some very nice things about Jonathan Jennings. We both like watching him play. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we both picked him as our – I know I picked him as the MOP this year in our season preview show. You did as well, no?
I believe I did, yes.
Yeah, so we both have think the world of Jonathan Jennings as a player. But are you noticing that he's not regressed, but kind of stagnated as a quarterback? He's got all the talent in the world, but it seems to me that he's making the same mistakes over and over again. How many interceptions did he have in this past game against Saskatchewan? Like, it just seems to me like as good as he is and as good as he could be, I think we're starting to see the player that he is. He's a guy who is going to have massive games, a huge upside, but he's also going to be he's going to make those boneheaded decisions. And I just wondered, do you feel the same way?
I do. I think that in his rookie season, you know, that was the knock on him. He made some bad decisions. In his second year, it was the same thing. And we're seeing it again in his third season. I believe this is his third season. Am I
it's
correct?
It's his second full season as a starter. But yeah, he came in.
But he played games.
Yeah, he started like six or seven games at the tail end of his first year.
Right.
So he started over 20 games in this league. And yeah, that's not a ton compared to some other quarterbacks, but I think it's enough to have a pretty good idea of who he is.
At some point, he has to put it all together and be that player that everyone expects him to be. I mean, he has all the potential in the world. He's got a strong arm. He can be accurate. He's mobile. He's a tall guy. So all the potential is there, but we're just not seeing it come to fruition, not seeing all the potential that he has come to fruition. So I don't know how much more time you give him, but at some point you're going to have to make a decision on him or Lule this season, because with Lule being in there and being so productive with that offense and all those weapons he has, Jennings might be the second guy at the end of the season, and Lule might be given another chance to be a starter in this league.
And you hear people defend Jennings and say, well, he's still young. He's only 25. And I get that. But maybe we look at him and I don't know about you, but I look at him and I see a bit more Kevin Glenn, Michael Bishop, Kerry Joseph than I do, say, Damon Allen, Tracy Ham, Doug Flutie. Like, he's a talented player, but he's prone to making those boneheaded mistakes. Like, we see guys like Kevin Glenn's had a 17-year career in the CFL, and I argued a few weeks ago that he should go to the Hall of Fame. Jonathan Jennings could be that player, but no one, and this is no disrespect to Kevin Glenn, no one wants to have Kevin Glenn's career. They want to have Doug Flutie's career, where you play 10 years and you set the world on fire. And there's all this potential in Jonathan Jennings, but his mistakes are the same over and over again. He throws into coverage. He makes bad reads, or at least that's what it looks like. Case in point, in this game against Saskatchewan that he just played, he got pulled at the end of the first half. Lule came in for two or three drives. Jennings came right back in, and on his first play of the third quarter, throws it into like triple coverage, nearly as it intercepted. Like, he's making the same mistakes over and over again. So maybe this is just the player that he's going to be. He's going to show you moments of brilliance and then moments of pinheadedry.
Yeah, and you can't really coach decision making. I mean, that's just in the heat of the moment. And he's making the wrong decisions, at least recently. So, yeah, it's a question mark right now if he is going to be a star quarterback in this league for years to come, because we all, I mean, everyone thought that he would be, but you just never know. You never know. I thought, you know, I'm not the best judgment because we've talked about this before, that I thought Stephen Giles was going to be a great quarterback, and that didn't turn out so well. So.
The old one-eyed wombat. Yeah, I was with you. I love Stephen Giles, too. I love Stephen Giles, too. But, and it can always turn around. Danny McManus wasn't a star quarterback until he was almost 30 years old. So anything can happen. Yeah. Another great example. Calvillo, like, some guys are late bloomers, but I don't know. I see in Jennings a world of talent, but I also see a lot of the hallmarks of a guy who will be very good, but maybe never great.
And speaking of Kevin Glenn, he looked like a Hall of Fame quarterback in the game he played this weekend, eh? Did you see that? That was pretty good.
Well, I didn't watch most of the game because, what was it, 29-0 at halftime? I think I tuned
out.
I tuned out maybe midway through the third quarter and decided to watch Game of Thrones. I know I'm a bad CFL fan.
No. It's I didn't watch, I don't think I watched the fourth quarter, but I put myself through hell and watched that 60-1 game, but I don't know why.
Well, that was because we had to talk about it. We don't have to talk about the Riders and the Lions. We're not a Riders or Lions podcast. We'll leave that to the BC Lions Den and the Piffles crew out there to talk about that game. So let's move on to some Ticats stuff. Let's preview this upcoming game against the Red Blacks. Ticats 0-7, and they're playing at home against the one win Ottawa Red Blacks. Mike, if they cannot win this game on Friday night, they might not win one all season. Like, seriously, I know there are 10 games left after this game, but if the Ticats lose this one at home against a team that you can argue is almost as bad as they are, the season is over. I know you said earlier you think the season's over, but to me, this is the game for me where I will dictate where I think this team will go. It's probably over now. Like, you're probably right. This team's probably not going to make the playoffs, but at least a win here would provide that small glimmer of hope that they may be able to finish in the playoffs and then get blown out by whatever team finishes fourth in the West.
Ottawa's, you know, they're hurting. They're a bad team as well, but it's funny. I was looking at the quarterback stats. Trevor Harris is leading the league in yards and touchdown. And you look at the record, it kind of reminds me of the year when Burris was our quarterback and he tore up the league offensively, but our record was, you know, 6-12 or whatever. So it's a bit of an odd thing going on in Ottawa. I don't know what to expect out of this game, but I'm hoping for a win. But you're right. If they don't beat the Eastern teams that are just not really that good, then, you know, if we're going to be bad, we might as well be epically bad. We might as well go for 0-18, right?
Oh, I do not want to hear the chirps if this team goes 0-18. Although, to be fair, if they get to, like, 0-14, I might root for the imperfect season, if you will.
Break the 1-17 record that the Ticats already have.
Yeah, I honestly, though, I don't think this team is 0-18 bad. You look at the schedule, they have home games. They play Ottawa three times. Ottawa's not good, but this is the only one they get them at home. So if they're going to win one, this is one. They get Saskatchewan later in the year, and I know Saskatchewan looked really good against BC, but Saskatchewan looked great at home, terrible on the road. Even if this team is a lost cause by Labor Day, I still think there's a couple of games that they can win. Because, yes, they play East teams, and the East is not good. But this is the worst team in the East that's not the Ticats. So if they can't beat this team, they're in tough to try to find a win this season. Offensively, honestly, I'm not going to go into too much analysis here. You know what the offense needs to do to win this game, Mike? They just need to score more points than their opponent. I don't care how or why. Just score more points than Ottawa. If Sergio Castillo has to kick 25 bloody rouges to win this game, I'll take it. I'll even go so far as to say I will take a 1-0 win with nothing but two and outs the entire game and the winning point coming off a punt that goes out the side of the end zone on the game's last play. I don't care how they get it done. Just get the goddamn win.
Yeah, I'd take 0.5 to nothing. It doesn't matter. All they have to do is they just have to win. And for the defense, it's not allow the team to score points.
Like, it's simple. It's simple. Offense needs to score. Yeah. Defense needs to stop from scoring. Like, we can't, like, at this point in the season, 0-7, they look bad. What more does anyone want us to say? We can't, like, we can go in depth and talk about, well, if they do that, but what's the point? We know they're not going to run the football. We know the secondary is probably going to give up a bunch of passing yards. We know what this team is. I don't care how they do it. Just get the win. I don't care. I don't care what it takes.
That's the shortest game preview that we've ever done, I think. Well, maybe the week after the Calgary loss. It was pretty short, too. But,
yeah.
I mean, you're right. What else can we say?
Yeah, this might be the shortest one we've ever done. So it's over. Let's move on to the picks. Four games this week, as always, Mike. It's a pretty decent slate of games. There's some good matchups here outside of, like, the Basement Bowl here in Hamilton on Friday. But we start Thursday night in the Peg. 5-2 Winnipeg Blue Bombers hosting the 7-0 Edmonton Eskimos. This is probably going to be the game of the week. Mike, who do you got in this one?
I'm going to stick with the Eskimos. I don't know. They just keep finding ways to win football games, and that's what good teams do. So I think Winnipeg's a good team too, but I'm going to take the Eskimos.
I really want to take the Bombers in this. Edmonton's going to lose eventually, but it's looking like it's going to be in that back-to-back with the Stamps, Labor Day, and then the following week. I, too, am taking the Eskimos. They just keep finding a way to win. This to me, though, I think this is going to be a hell of a football game. The exact opposite of that is taking place here in Hamilton on Friday night. As we previously mentioned, the 1-6-1 Ottawa Red Blacks come to Hamilton to take on the 0-7 Hamilton Tiger Cats. Mike, what's your choice for this one?
I'm sorry, I just can't be burned by this team anymore. I'm taking Ottawa. I'm taking Ottawa.
You traitor. You bloody traitor. I'm taking the Ticats, and here's why. Because they have to win this game. Because if they don't win this game, I don't know how I'm going to be able to pick them the rest of the year. This, we said a couple weeks ago, this homestand, this three games, Winnipeg, Ottawa, Toronto, this is where they had to win some games. I said they had to win at least two of them. They lost the first one. They have to win this game. If they don't win this game, the season is over. So this is the last eatsy-beatsy wheat pit of hope I have left in my body. I'm taking the Ticats to win this game. God damn it, do I hope I'm right. Second half of a Friday night doubleheader sees a very good game in British Columbia as the Stamps head there to play the Lions. Mike, who do you like in this one?
After that performance last week against the Riders, you know, they're probably going to come out and have a fire lit under their ass and put a decent performance in, but I'm still taking Calgary just because they're Calgary and they win football games.
I think this has an opportunity to be one of the better games this week as well. BC at home, it's tough to pick against them, but the Stamps coming off a bye are pretty much a lock. So I got to go with the Stamps. But I think it's going to be a lot closer. I think BC put up a stinker against Saskatchewan, and teams, that happens. Calgary lost to Montreal a few weeks ago. So you're probably, it would, look at Edmonton. Edmonton nearly gave two wins to the Ticats. They could very easily be 5-2 and not 7-0, and the Ticats could have, like, teams are very close in this league, and good teams get blown out all the time, but Calgary off a bye, damn near undefeated, and they might be undefeated out of the last few years. I don't know the numbers, but I'm not picking against the Stamps coming off a bye. Last game of the week, Saturday in Toronto, rematch from a week before, Alouettes at the Argos. Mike, who do you got in this one?
The question mark with Ricky Ray is the deciding factor for me. If he's not playing, I don't think the Argos have my... Although, Fajardo, I do like what I've seen from Fajardo at times, but I think the Alouettes started to click on offense last week, and they look pretty good, so I'm going to take the Alouettes.
This is tough because it all does depend on who plays quarterback for the Argos. If it's Ray, definitely take the Argos. If it's Fajardo, who I think it's going to be, I'll lean slightly to the Argos. If Matthew starts, the Owls are going to crush them. So I think Fajardo's going to start this game. It's hard to beat a team twice in back-to-back games, so I am going to side ever so slightly with the Toronto Argonauts in this one. So you and I have a couple different this week. I took the two Ontario – well, I guess Ottawa's an Ontario team too. I took the two Southern Ontario teams, and you took their two opponents. Interesting strategy.
Mm-hmm. We shall see, my friend.
We shall see. All right, let's move on to questions. We got three good ones this week. As always, they came from Adam. He's the guy who always asks us questions. He's basically the unofficial third member of this podcast. So first up, pretty simple, Mike. What is the minimum number of wins Kent Austin needs to keep his job?
That's a tough question. I'm going to say 7.
7. That's a high number. Any reason for 7?
Well, I just think that maybe 7 you might sneak into the playoffs, but I don't know. This season has just been a real, real downer, and I don't know if he does keep his job at the end of the season, no matter. Like, if they find a way to turn the season around, then yes, he'll stay, but if they get, you know, floating around 5-6 wins, then there might be some changes. So I'm gonna go with 7.
Okay, I took 5, and honestly, 5 could get you second place in the East with how bad these teams are. I don't think it will. I think 5 would probably get you third place, and at third place, you're not making the playoffs. But at third place, you're still better than the team in last place, who would probably end up being Ottawa, honestly. I just think that, especially if they string together like 3 wins in their last 5, and it looks like things are starting to turn around, they would give him another year, because he did sign a contract extension a couple years ago. He is so, like, intertwined in the front office. Like, to fire him, you're gutting everything and you're starting from scratch. I don't know.
A rebuild.
It is. It's a complete overhaul. Now, to be fair, the last time they did this, they fired George Cortez after a 6-win season, brought in Ken Austin, and went with the back-to-back Grey Cup. So you can turn a team around in quick order if you get the right people in. And at the time, obviously, those were the right people. But I think if they show improvement down the stretch and can string together some wins, I think 5 would be enough to keep his job. I think you could – look, there are going to be fans that are calling for his – even if they win 7 games and make the playoffs and lose in the first round, you're going to be seeing fans calling for his head anyway. So you can't listen to what fans say. So I'll say 5, and I think, honestly, he's probably back for – unless things really go south, like a winless season, I think he's back next year regardless. But that's just my opinion. Next question is, how many wins does a second-place finisher in the East have this season? And does the second place team in the West have double that total?
I'm going to say the second place team has 8 wins. And that would make 16 wins for the Western Division's second place team. So, no, I do not see that happening. That would be, that's a lot of wins. That's a lot of wins, especially for a second place team. Maybe they may get 13 wins, 14 maybe, but not 15 or 16.
Yeah, that's what I have. I got 7 wins for the second place team in the East, and I think that's just shy of being half of the number 2 team in the West. I think either Calgary, maybe even Edmonton, perhaps. Well, it doesn't matter. Those 4 teams in the West, top to bottom, they're the 4 best teams in the league, no doubt. One of them is going to finish with probably 13 wins in second place, and I think that's just slightly lower than half of the 7 wins that the East team will get. Last question, Michael. This is a good one. This is a longer question. It's basically, who are your most outstanding player, most outstanding defensive player, most outstanding Canadian, and most outstanding special teams player after the 1/3 mark of the season? So let's go. Let's do this award by award. Let's start with most outstanding special teams player. Who do you have here?
I've got Medlock. He's just – he hasn't been perfect this year. He's missed some kicks, but that guy is just so important to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. And he's just a – solid kicker and punter, and I looked at the averages for punting last game, and he was averaging 60 yards a punt. So that was kind of a little bit of a knock on him when he was with the Ticats. Was, yeah, he's a tremendous field goal kicker, but his punting isn't that great, and I think that he's really improved on that since he's been with the Bombers, so I'm going to go with Medlock.
I got Medlock as well. He's such a weapon for the 57-yard field goal for them this week. They basically just across half. They have a shot to score with him, and he's the best kicker in the league, maybe the best kicker to ever play in this league. And for me, after 6 games this season, I can't really argue anyone else. Most outstanding Canadian, who do you have here?
You gotta go with Andrew Harris. I think that he's had a tremendous season. He's on pace for 1,000 yards receiving, 1,000 yard rushing. We all know that that's more than likely not going to happen. But this guy has been tremendous this year, and you know how I felt about him in the past. He's changed my mind. He should be the most outstanding Canadian, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a tough one to argue, but I picked Alex Singleton, defensive player, kind of the leader of that Stamps defense. He's a tackling machine. Mm-hmm. He's all over the place. I can't argue against Andrew Harris, but I can argue for Alex Singleton, and I just think he's been incredible for the Stampeders. He was incredible for them last year, and there's been a lot of good Canadians, most of them playing out west, of course, but I took Singleton there. This one, to me, the next one, most outstanding defensive player, was tough. Who did you pick here?
I got a kind of a off-the-board type of name. I got Victor Butler from Toronto. He leads the league in sacks. And he's just been really a pleasure to watch on the field. He's a baller, and he's a rookie, and you know, you might argue that he doesn't deserve it, but he also leads the league in forced fumbles. So this guy's just making plays every time he gets out there. So I got Victor Butler right now.
Yeah, and he's missed a couple of games too. Like I think he's missed the last two Argos games. So he was putting up some massive numbers for them. If he can get back, I could easily see him winning most sustaining defensive player. I went a little off the board with mine too, and I picked Kenny Ladler. He has just all around been a great defensive player for the Eskimos this year. I don't think he will ultimately win most outstanding defensive player, but I think after the first six games, I think he's been really, really, really good. And he's a guy who doesn't get a lot of publicity, but I just, every time I watch the Eskimos play, he's making plays, whether it's knocking passes down, get interceptions or whatever. He's just kind of that jack of all trades. You know who he reminds me of? Markeith Knowlton. Very much is kind of out there doing it all, and that's what Ladler is. And Knowlton did win most sustained defensive player back in, I think it was 2010, so it's possible. But after six games, he's my most sustained defensive player, Kenny Ladler. Now, the big one. I think we're probably in agreement on who we have as most outstanding player in the league.
You think so?
I think, well, I'd be shocked if you didn't have Mike Riley.
I looked at Mike Riley, and he's been incredible. I just don't think the numbers are there right now. He's third in passing TDs, third in passing yards. I'm going to go with Greg Ellingson. Leads the league in touchdown catches and leads the league in receiving yards. So I've been really high on him, you know, even back in his Ticat days. But he's changed into one of the elite receivers, if not the elite receiver in the league right now. So he just impresses me every single game. I'm going with Ellingson.
I'm speechless. I am stunned. I would have bet money that you would have picked Mike Riley. I did pick Mike Riley, obviously. Come on. The guy has been outstanding. His team is undefeated. He's done it all for that team with a ridiculously depleted roster. How many of his top receivers are missing? How many just players on that team? They got something like 17, 18 of their former starters out, and he just keeps producing, and they just keep winning. I know it's not MVP, and I know it's not – oh, you're right. His numbers aren't top of the table right now, but you can't do anything but love what Mike Riley's done. But you make a strong case for Greg Ellingson, because as a most outstanding player, I might have to give you the nod there. You might be right there, leading in both touchdown catches and in yards on a team where he's no longer – doesn't have Chris Williams and Ernest Jackson there anymore to take pressure off him. He's the guy there now. He's still putting up those numbers. The only knock against him is his team stinks. And very rarely do you see – and again, we're not projecting – this is not our projections for the season. This is who we have right now. But if Ottawa misses the playoffs, I think it's very rare that you'll see a guy even be like the division's candidate on a team with a losing record that misses the playoffs. There was a few years ago, Henry Burris, the year Chad Owens won MOP, Henry Burris probably should have been the most outstanding. Actually, Chris Williams should have been the most outstanding player nominee for the Ticats and probably should have been the most outstanding player for the East Division at least, because he was doing it on offense and on special teams. He won most outstanding special teams player that year. But they finished 6-10 or 6-12, and you missed the playoffs. You're forgotten about. That unfortunately could probably happen with Ellingson.
Yeah, and as we go on, I think if Edmonton keeps rolling and they keep winning, and by the end of the season, Riley's going to have some pretty impressive numbers, I'd say. So, you know, things could change even six games from now. So, yeah, I totally get that pick by you. Mike Riley's one hell of a player. He, every time I go watch him play at the stadium, he impresses me. So, yeah, I can't argue with your pick as well.
Yeah, hopefully when we get to game 12, Adam will remember to ask us this question again, and we'll revisit who our award winners are for these four awards at the two-thirds mark of the season. But that is it, Mike. We are done for the week. That's the show. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or listen to it, or download it at 3downnation.com. If you want to hit us up with a question, you're more than welcome to on Twitter. Mike, your Twitter handle, please.
Mike_Ticats.
And I am JoshSmith_82. Or you can post those questions in the comment section on 3 Down Nation when this goes up. That was episode 84, Mike. We're getting close to the 100th episode of the show, but we're 16 away. Episode 84, Potsky Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham. Win a damn game.
Just win, baby. Just win.
Thanks for listening. Find more great shows like this at CF Pod Network on Twitter.